Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Listening to Justice, podcast series exploring all aspects of the criminal justice system with me, prison philanthropist and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor.
In this episode, I talk to Dr. Lucy Baldwin, senior lecturer in criminology at De Montfort University and previously qualified social worker and probation officer. I talk to Lucy about her motivations to work in the field of mothers and their children in the justice system and what she believes needs to be done to better protect and support them.
My name is Dr. Lucy Baldwin, and I am a senior lecturer in criminology at De Montfort University. And in my former lives, I've been I'm a qualified social worker and probation officer. So sadly, I am so old that I have 35 years experience in the criminal justice system. A lot of years have kind of brought me to this point.
And what has led you into this field of sort of mothering justice, and particularly looking at the plight of not just women, but particularly mothers and their children in the criminal justice system? How did you get there?
It was a strange pathway, I think. And I think it's kind of, it's one that has come from lots of different places. I had quite a difficult childhood, with lots of really negative experiences, and left home very young and became a mother very young. I was pregnant at 16 and then had another baby when I was 18. And so I think mothering for nearly all of my life has been central in one way or another, like most women, I suppose. But it's been the biggest part of my life one way or another. So I think my personal experiences and growing up as a teenage mum in the 80s and remembering that judgment towards teenage mums and, you know, the whole Margaret Thatcher spiel and the Conservative Party spiel of, you know, single mothers are the scourge of society and the cause of all of, you know, discontent and offending youth. So I remember that stigma, and I remember not enjoying that stigma. And I also remember the expectation that I would fail as a mother because I was so young, and having to kind of fight for people to change their opinions, and me also having to constantly prove people wrong.
And did you feel that that was a sort of political discourse that was coming out, but was that also sort of media, you know, the influence of media that's so pervasive, isn't it?
Absolutely. There were headlines. I referred to some of them in my PhD, but, you know, I remember them vividly, those attitudes and the negative opinions. And actually, I wasn't a single mum for all of that time. I was actually married very, very young. But when I was pregnant, I couldn't wear my rings because of my fingers swelling. And when I went onto the ward, I was offered a wedding ring by the ward sister, who said, "We keep a box of rings on the ward for girls like you."
Oh, my goodness.
Mm-hmm. And that was 1983. It was very, very bizarre. And you really felt that because of the media, because of how people reacted to you, because of the TV. It was something that had a profound effect on me. It really did. And I remember that really quite deeply.
Did you feel able to challenge that at the time? Or did you do what actually most of us do when you're in such shock? You look a bit startled and you sort of don't say anything and you accept the ring.
Yeah, no, I didn't. I didn't feel able to challenge it at the time. I really didn't. And interestingly, I did later, because when I was doing my master's, I was actually pregnant with my daughter, but I had the same consultant that I'd had when I'd had my boys. And he'd come along and he'd seen that I was writing my thesis in labour in the hospital, as you do, yes, as you do. And because I was being induced, and he was like, "Oh my dear, what have we got here? What are we doing?" And I explained to him, and so then he said to me, "Oh, would you like a single room? Would you like to be away from those people?" Because he reacted to me completely different, because I was doing a master's at Durham than how he'd reacted to me as a 16, 17-year-old girl when he'd actually dismissed me for crying when they used to do internals then. And I actually said to him then, "You are treating me very differently to how you treat me when I was a young girl. And no, I wouldn't like a private room, because those people are the reason that both you and I have a job." Because that was my social work master's. So,
and how did he react to that out of interest?
He was very kind about it, actually. He really listened. He sat down and had a conversation with me. And I was really quite shocked by that, because he was a really quite mature consultant by that time, and renowned for being grumpy with some people. But he did, he actually sat down and had a conversation with me, and for the rest of that pregnancy he couldn't have looked after me better.
It's interesting, isn't it? It's something I think about a lot within the criminal justice system, and particularly when it comes to court, when it's kind of like the educated versus the uneducated in many ways, and it's like this sort of weaponizing your intellect, actually, and the fact that he saw you had a brain and you were studying, therefore he was going to treat you like a more civilized human being. And I just think it's an interesting sort of concept to think about.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think there's far too much of that othering that goes on. You know, anybody who writes with me knows I can't stand the phrase "these women." And I think it's because for me, it makes me feel that people are being othered. And, you know, I was just as clever whether I had a qualification or not. I was just as human whether I had a qualification or not. I was just as decent whether I had children at 16 or whether, you know, when I was having my daughter at 28 in the middle of a master's. So I think there is that temptation to other. And I think there's all of those feelings of injustice tied up with my experiences as a social worker and a probation officer, and watching women really survive against all the odds, but also mother and mother well against the odds. You know, women are incredibly resilient. I'm not saying men aren't, they are, but women are often dealing with so much more whilst trying to parent. And I think you can't help but be impressed by that, particularly of women in the criminal justice system. And there's always this assumption that because you've become criminalised, or because you live in poverty, or because you're disadvantaged, that you're automatically a bad mother. And I think it's that frustration and anger against those beliefs that made me want to, I think, actively pursue working with mothers and children more actively. I've worked with men and women throughout my career, but I think it's working with mothers and children that I think I've always found the most rewarding.
Right. And today we're particularly talking about mothers in the criminal justice system. So for any of our listeners that might not know the criminal justice system at all, some people who are listening will know it inside out. But could you paint a picture of the problem that we actually have?
I think for women in the criminal justice system, the biggest problem is that there are so many missed opportunities before women come into the criminal justice system. So I think really, in relation to women particularly, we criminalise poverty and we criminalise trauma. And had women had support at much earlier times during their lives, then very often they would never have become criminalised at all. And I think that's one of the biggest issues, is just the lack of support that's available for women when they're vulnerable to becoming criminalised, and there's just not enough opportunity to intervene in that stage to prevent the next stage even occurring.
Right, and particularly in that bit, we know that women particularly can suffer abuse sort of within their relationships, and it's much more relational, isn't it, with the women compared to the men? Not saying that men don't run into trouble with their relationships, because of course they do, but it's much more emphasised, isn't it, with the women?
Definitely. And I think, you know, I mean, over 50% of women we know have experienced abuse in their relationships and in their childhood, or both. And they're the ones we know about. You know, I mean, my experience in prison, and I'm sure yours is exactly the same, is that it's, in reality, I think it's probably far higher than 50%, but not everybody reports it, or not everybody has become a recognised statistic, partly because of the lack of support, but partly because of an acceptance that this is a way of life and a reluctance to report for all of the reasons that most of us will know about. And I think that that in itself brings incredible challenges because, I mean, you know, just last week I was talking to a mum who was prosecuted for taking drugs into prison, but she was forced into that by a violent partner who had said to her, if you don't, not only will I beat you, but I'll beat your children. And you know, she was kind of saying, what choice did I have? And in reality, as a mother, if somebody who you believe and know to be a violent person because of experience is telling you they will beat your child if you don't take these drugs into prison, what could most mums do in that situation, particularly if, as she had, you'd grown up in a violent house, you'd grown up with violence, it was part of your life, you knew and expected it to come, and you didn't have the skills or the support or the ability to walk away from that or to resist that.
And that seems to be the bit that has often been missed. I mean, I remember when I sat on the advisory board for female offenders, which was advising the government on the reforms of the female prison estate. And you know, that was back sort of pre-2018 when the female offender strategy was actually published. So it was the 5 years before that. But it's like there was, it was the first time in a way that the government had a recognition that the pathways for women going into the prison system and the criminal justice system were inextricably linked to men's violence. And I sat there through so many meetings, and not just on that board, but in different areas as well, in different meetings, where there was a defensiveness that came from the men. And this isn't a criticism, it's just something I observed over years and years and years, that they didn't want to really accept that, because they saw it as women blaming men for women behaving badly. And it was a real shame, but I was quite young at the time. And I remember thinking, God, this isn't very mature and very adult if people are going to get defensive about actually what is just a fact and something that we need to dig into. Do you think that's getting better now?
I think that defensiveness is difficult to deal with because it creates issues. I think sometimes the judiciary are defensive, and I think men in general can be defensive. But that's not to say you don't have fantastic male practitioners and male men who in the criminal justice system who are deeply, deeply aware of the issues and really want to address them. I mean, Lord Farmer would be an obvious example for a start. But I know lots and lots of prison officers, police officers, probation officers who are male who do a fantastic job and who don't get defensive and who do recognise that. So I think on an individual level, it's got much better. And I think men, male role models are starting to realise the importance of their role, actually, with women in criminal justice, in being a positive role model. So I think on an individual level and a grassroots level, a practitioner level, it's definitely got better. But I think in terms of the level you're talking about, I think there is still that reluctance to recognise and accept the patriarchal society that we live in. Has influenced men, but it's also influenced policy and practice that have developed and continues to influence and shape the criminal justice system and the prison system in favour of men, and which can really result in women's needs being neglected or not met at all. And I think that's where the challenges lie in recognising that without defensiveness. And I think we are in a better place in terms of a willingness to move forward positively than I think we've ever been. I mean, you know, I've just been involved in an edited collection with some brilliant academic partners, and Pat Carlin wrote the foreword for it, and it was a book that we're working on is kind of it's an updated version of Criminal Women, which was written in the early 1980s, 83 I think, and But really, sadly, we are calling for exactly the same things that Pat Carlin called for in the 80s. So this knowledge isn't new. Yeah. And I think that's exactly right. We are asking for the same things that we've asked for a very long time. And the knowledge isn't new about women's pathways into offending or women's pathways out of offending. It really, really isn't. But I think I'm cautiously optimistic that there is enough will and enough movement to move forward positively at the minute. And, you know, notwithstanding some of the challenges around the new 500 spaces and the expansion of the prison estate, I think aside from that, there is definitely some positive progression that I see at a grassroots level in the prisons, and your organisation being accepted into that and being brought into the prisons and being part of working life in prisons now, I think is part of that. You wouldn't have had that 10 years ago.
I'd take you back even further to maybe Elizabeth Fry, because having read of some of her works, you know, you kind of go, oh my God, it's 2021 and we're saying the same thing. And then I found this brilliant quote by Baroness Corston in 2007 in one of your academic articles that you'd quoted. And it said, there can be few topics that have been so exhaustively researched to such little practical effect as the plight of women in the justice system. No, absolutely. So could you maybe give us an example of a woman who is either pregnant or has a child and, you know, kind of going into the court area and maybe sort of take the listener through a bit of a journey from court to prisons maybe and then out into the community and what might be typical?
Well, it's probably easier if I refer to several women, I think, rather than one woman. And I'll talk to you about one woman's experience who I was talking to just the other day. We assume that everybody who comes into the criminal justice system knows everything about how the prison system works or what works. And I was talking to a mum last week who had no knowledge of that. She was coming into prison as somebody who didn't have a criminal background. It was a first offence and she was pregnant. She didn't even know that mother and baby units existed. So as a pregnant mum and as a very pregnant mum, she was in her last 5 weeks of pregnancy. She had no idea that her child potentially could come into prison with her. So she'd gone into the police station and arrested and just been consumed with thoughts about her baby and the baby being born in prison and what on earth was going to happen. The same in court. She had no knowledge. Nobody had spoken to her and said, you can apply for an MBU, your baby might come into prison. And there was nothing. And she actually came up with a fantastic idea about that there needs to be some kind of posters and information in police stations and in courts, which actually I've taken to birth companions and I think they're going to run with. But she sat there in the police station, in the court, not having a clue that her baby might be able to stay with her. And so she was trying to prepare herself for her baby being taken from her. And I mean, how do you prepare for that? Imagine that. She couldn't concentrate on any of the processes, any of the court processes, because all she was thinking about was that her child was going to be taken. Thankfully for that mum, she was advised as soon as she was taken into the prison. She had a really good example of when things go well, and she was advised straight away that she could apply for an MBU space. There's a MBU board, or the mother and baby unit board, where a number of people sit to kind of assess an application for a mother and baby unit place. And sometimes they're sat, for women who've been in prison a long time, sometimes they don't get sat until a woman is in labour. Occasionally it happens after she's had the baby. So women can spend all of that whole time period in prison not knowing whether they're going to have their baby with them or not, not knowing whether they're going to have a space or not. And actually, we have quite a high rejection rate for the mother and baby unit boards.
Just quickly, am I right in saying the 6 mother and baby units across the 12 women's prisons in this country?
That's right, yeah. There's space for, I think it's 64 babies altogether. There's an allowance for twins. I could be wrong on that one, but I'll check that out. But this mum was fortunate. She had a very quick board and she had a very quick answer. So she was actually given a space on an MBU, and she spent the last few weeks of her pregnancy on the MBU and had her baby through the MBU, which doesn't always happen. sometimes, like I say, women spend the whole of their pregnancy in the normal location, which can be terrifying for women. But this mum was lucky, and she's on an MBU, and she will stay on that MBU. However, her sentence is longer than the period that the baby is allowed to stay on the MBU. So babies are allowed to stay for 18 months. Occasionally, individual MBU managers, if the mum is due out when the child is, say, 20 months or 21 months, they might extend that stay, and they can extend it up to 2 years.
That's so interesting, because I wrote my dissertation as an undergraduate 20 years ago on mother and baby units and the attachment theory and the damage, the irreparable damage sometimes that we do to babies and mothers when we remove them. And that was almost 20 years ago. And it sounds to me like that hasn't changed.
No, we still have women who are dealing with that. I mean, Laura Abbott, myself and Sinead O'Malley, we wrote a chapter on from the children's rights perspective, you know, and looked at the harms and the psychological and long-term harms, actually, to the child of being an MBU baby and going through that stress of being inside a prison-based mum, and what if, you know, the impact of that separation. But yes, yeah, so this mum will actually end up being separated from her child because her sentence is longer. So at some point, her child will be taken out. And that in itself, I mean, I've known mums who choose not to have their children with them on the MBU because they can't bear the thought of that 18 months of loving and close contact and then the separation. So I've known mums who make the decision not to have the child with them.
So to prevent them from bonding at all, in a way, it's like, get it done now, take the baby away.
Mm-hmm. And I've known other mums who've had to make a really difficult decision because, like you said, there are only 6 MBUs. So mums sometimes have to make the choice between moving to an MBU, which might be many, many, many miles further away from home, which might mean that their other children who are too old to be on an MBU are left at home and then can't visit because mum is so far away with the new baby. So effectively, we're kind of asking mums to do a Sophie's choice of, well, do I choose to keep the baby with me and move to an MBU, which means I can't see my children, or do I choose to keep all my children together so that I can see them sometimes, but that means not having my baby with me in here? And you cannot imagine the agony of those decisions as a mother. It's horrible that we have women in those situations.
Yeah, it beggars belief. And just going back to the sort of court area, do judges ask a woman about their... I mean, I have done a podcast with Dr. Shona Minson about this, if any of the listeners are interested to go deeper into this. But she's obviously done a lot of work on trying to get this improved, hasn't she? But where are we up to now? Do judges ask women whether they have children?
There's been additional guidance following Shona, myself and Shona and a number of others like Laura Abbott. We gave evidence to the Joint Human Rights Inquiry into Maternal Imprisonment and the Rights of the Child. And following that inquiry, there was an additional report that came out that's available online if people are interested. And the recommendations from there were kind of reiterating the previous guidance that judges must ask and they must also account for, not just ask, but they must account for the children. And the Bangkok rules, which are, you know, global international rules that kind of are meant to guide sentences in relation to sentencing pregnant women and women with dependent children. And again, they're available online. And if sentences were consistently mindful of even that guidance, we would see fewer women come into prison pregnant or fewer women with dependent children. But sadly, we know from research that, you know, it's not a consistent response. There are some fantastic sentences who will always ask and who will always be mindful of children and will always be mindful of the impact of a maternal imprisonment on children. But there are other sentences who, either because they're not knowledgeable about women's offending, or they're not knowledgeable about the local area alternatives, or there aren't any local alternatives in the community, then they feel like they have no choice but to still sentence women to prison. And I think that appears to be slowly changing. I think the drip-drip effect of people like myself and Shauna and Laura Abbott and Birth Companions and Women in Prison and yourself, I feel like we're having some impact and sentences are becoming more aware, and there are local areas where they have gendered courts, which I think is really important, and they have diversion schemes, which are really important. And in those areas, you, and it is mostly magistrates who sentence women because of the relatively minor nature of most of their offending. And in those areas where relationships between women centres, for example, and women are positive, we see shifts in sentencing behaviour, and we see that consideration, but it's not consistent.
So it's important, I think, to point out also that the UK has the highest rates of women's imprisonment in Western Europe, and that three quarters of women serving prison sentences in this country, well, in England and Wales, but there's no women's prison in Wales, so only in England, three quarters of women are serving sentences of less than 12 months. So, you know, it's interesting to sort of get those facts out there, isn't it? Because it, context is everything. And also, I think it's crucial to point out that while some women will go onto a mother and baby unit, some pregnant women find themselves on the wings, right?
Definitely. I mean, Rona Epstein and myself, we did a piece of research in 2017 called Short But Not Sweet, and that specifically looked at the impact of maternal imprisonment for mothers who were serving short sentences. And in that report, we had three pregnant mums two mums lost their babies in prison, actually, one in handcuffs in an ambulance on the way to hospital and one in her cell overnight. And both of those mums felt that the stress of being in prison and the stress of and the fear and the anxiety of being pregnant in a normal location contributed to their miscarriage. We'll never know for certain, but it's common knowledge that amongst those of us that are involved in this work, that women who are pregnant in prison are incredibly stressed. They experience fear for themselves, fear for their tummies, fear for their baby. They experience a reluctance to bond because of the fact the baby might not stay with them. They experience hunger. They experience discomfort in terms of the provisions and the mattresses. It's a real challenge to be pregnant in prison.
Was it summer 2019, the case you're talking about, when a lady hit her alarm button a few times, no one came, and the baby was born in the cell? And the baby wasn't alive when the officer arrived. Now, I don't know the details of the case, so we won't go into it too much, but I think it's important to give the listener who maybe doesn't know much about this topic that it is really a genuine problem. And often when people say, well, there's hardly any women in prison and there aren't that many pregnant women, there aren't that many children affected, oh, the number of babies is so low, that doesn't matter. Not only is that utterly horrific for the mother and the trauma of that, but for the staff as well. You know, you could argue, yes, that someone should have got there quicker, but the prison system is the prison system. You know, a staff member arriving into that scene as well. You know, this can all be avoided, I think, is what we're saying, isn't it?
Definitely. It absolutely could. I mean, sadly, there's been three baby deaths in the last, I think, 3.5 years, two in prison cells and one on the way to hospital when they didn't get to the hospital in time. And, you know, we'll never know for certain whether those babies would have survived had they been born outside of prison. But the likelihood is, with all of the babies, that with medical intervention, that they would have done. And I think you're right, we need to avoid this happening in the future. And Level Up have a campaign at the minute that is to see a presumption against sending any pregnant women to prison at all. And I think that has to be the way forward. That has to be the path that we...
Okay, but just on that, just a challenge, because I can then hear the voices in my head going, or the people that might say, well, then surely a woman will just get herself knocked up, get a bun in the oven before she is heading to court, and then she'll be let off. So
I don't think you can always legislate for an exception. I personally, knowing women in this area, I don't think that many women would go to those lengths to avoid a prison sentence, because we all know having a child is a lifelong commitment, and if you're not ready for it, it's not something many women would choose to do to avoid a prison sentence. So I think I accept that some people will have that argument, but I don't accept that it's a very valid one. I think there might potentially be one or two people that would ever do that, but the benefits of not sending women to prison who are pregnant would far outweigh that exceptional stance. And yeah. I still think, regardless, we need to pursue that avenue, really.
I like that saying, you can't legislate for the exception, because there'll always be exceptions to every rule, won't there? But that isn't an argument to then overrule sense.
Absolutely. And it is about common sense. And it's also about moral decency. You know, there are alternative ways to respond to women in the criminal who become criminalized. And, you know, prison is not our only option. We know that prison is a lot less effective statistically than community alternatives. So even the moral arguments that, you know, we must still send people to prison, they don't stand up, because financially, emotionally, physically, practically, psychologically, the benefits far outweigh the losses in terms of women being rehabilitated in the community. And we know that all singing, all dancing community order, the very most it will cost would be around about 8,000, but most cost far, far less, around about 2. Whereas a prison sentence for a woman in custody is nearer 60,000, and that's more if it's with a child. So even on a financial argument alone, it makes no sense.
And that's also tip of the iceberg, because you've got the woman's prison sentence, but then, you know, if you then talk about children, a child or children being taken into care, you know, the cost of all of that, and then, you know,
you could easily end up at 1 million for a woman with 2 or 3 children whose children are then taken into care. And just imagine what you could provide in terms of rehabilitation for a tenth of that. It makes no sense that we still continue to do this, when all of the evidence shows us that it, for the most part, prison does not work, and especially it does not work for women.
So then if we're going to look at the community sentences then, I mean, you know, there's problems obviously in the community, what with the probation service having been privatised, that was an anticipated disaster. It has been a disaster, so now they're unravelling that. And that's problematic for men and women, pregnant women, non-pregnant women, everyone who's caught up in it, including the staff. However, what does good look like then? So a woman is pregnant in court, it's low-level acquisitive crime, maybe she doesn't have an addiction, it's quite straightforward in a sense. So then she gets given a community sentence by the magistrate. So then can you paint a picture of what maybe good might look like? I mean, you can even pretend you have a magic wand if you want.
If I had a magic wand, then I would make sure that all women are supervised in the community, in women-only resources, by women-only teams, by probation officers who have a women-only caseload. And that is purely and simply because many women in the criminal justice system have multiple needs. Not all women, but a lot of women do. And whilst they are usually hugely strong and resilient women, they also have a number of vulnerabilities, and those vulnerabilities take time. So asking a probation officer to carry a mixed gender load and allocating the same time to supervise men and women can be really challenging. So I think there's a valid argument for gendered teams and for probation officers to supervise women only. I think all women ought to be, I mean, my research particularly, but lots of other research demonstrates that their needs are far better met if they're met via a women's centre. And you have a women's centre, and if we're having a magic wand, that would be a women's centre that was permanently funded, which is really, really important, that is permanently funded, that has access to multiple professionals, so like your Hope Street intends to have, and I mean, I think your Hope Street is probably a bit like a women's centre with a magic wand. It's going to look like that, really.
We hope. I'm going to hand a magic wand to every member of staff, hopefully, but...
Yeah, no, I think that's important. And I think it has to be a space where women... I mean, I remember going up to a women's centre called Glasgow 218. I don't know if you've ever been. It's a fantastic women's centre, and going into that women's centre, because it's permanently funded, you've got staff who've been there 10, 20, 15 years. That doesn't always happen in our women's centres, because women have to, the staff have to reapply for their jobs every 3 or 4 years. That has an impact. That's not to say we don't have some fantastic women's centres with fantastic long-standing staff, because we do, but they do it under a sword of Damocles.
And if you're going to look after people who've been traumatized and you're trying to help women and children or men and boys, whatever, you know, you need a stable foundation of the finances, 100%. Don't you?
That stability is really important, but also is the ability to recognize the root causes of offending and to address those. So if you do have women with addiction, happy people don't become addicted generally. So if you have a woman who is addicted to substances, 9 times out of 10, she's become addicted to substances because of a trauma that she's gone through, and a trauma that is probably ongoing, but certainly the after effects are kind of impacting on her need to use substances. So that trauma, that initial trauma, and the initial failure to support that trauma, and the resulting perpetuating trauma needs to be addressed. But on top of that, you've also got, if women are mothers, very often they'll have a guilt on top of that trauma about the impact of their trauma and their substance misuse on their children. And so that feeds into their emotions that are very difficult for women to deal with. I mean, we all know women who are not criminalised, you know, we feel guilty if we don't give our children enough, if we give them too much, if we work, if we don't work. Motherhood and guilt are synonymous, but for criminalised women, the fact that they're criminalised and the fact that they might have been using substance is a hook to hang their guilt on. And that perpetuates a cycle of, I can't deal with these maternal emotions of guilt, so I'm going to use substances because I can't cope, and I'm going to use substances. And then that can lead to loss of babies, which then you've got a situation where you've got a mum who, the trauma's not been addressed and she's lost a child. So what is that mum going to do? It stands to reason she's going to revert to her only coping mechanism, which is her substance misuse, and she will replace the child and have another child. So we have this cycle of women who end up having child after child, and that comes from a place where their trauma originally was not responded to appropriately. So I think addressing trauma and tying it up with women's maternal emotions and women's lived experience is really important, and dealing with that in an informed way in a gender specific place is really important. That's the thing, they're the things that make the difference.
Right. And your academic work is sort of seen through a matricentric lens, right? And I think that was a new word for me. And I presume it sort of means putting the mother, seeing things through the sort of mothering lens, if you like. And I was reflecting on that before we started recording this podcast, because having 3 children myself, it's interesting that, you know, you become a mother, it's all quite overwhelming, you change so much as a person, and then you sort of get into your rhythm and life moves on, you have another one and maybe another one. And I was just thinking about what that meant for me, actually. And it is sort of, then I was like, oh yeah, of course, like every single decision I make is seen through the lens of these 3 human beings, everything, the time I get up, you know, the rhythm of my day, how long I can be somewhere else, whether I book a holiday, like literally everything is dependent and goes through the sort of child funnel. And I hadn't really consciously thought about that before until I was doing a bit of research before the podcast, and it was just an interesting one.
Definitely. And I think that's the case for women coming into prison. I mean, women coming into prison who are mothers have an additional layer of challenge, of harm, of impact that women who don't have children are. That's not to say that it's a difficult one, because you can't, there's no hierarchy of it necessarily being harder, but it's a layer of complexity that needs to be factored in. And I think that's really important, because if you have a mum who comes into custody, and we know it happens all too often that mothers have either been advised that they weren't going to get a custodial sentence or that they weren't expecting one. So we have mums who come into custody who have dropped their child at school expecting to pick that child up. that mum, that woman coming into prison with that on her head, not knowing who was going to pick up her child, not knowing who was going to tell a child that she's in prison, not knowing when she's going to see that child or not knowing she's going to contact that child, that woman coming into custody is going to have a different experience to a woman coming in without children. And I think it's recognising that harm and that vulnerability and that risk, actually, that if that mum doesn't get that phone call home very quickly, or to somebody who can pick up that child or organise a childcare, how vulnerable she is that night. The number of women I speak to who talked about being suicidal in their first days and weeks in custody, and that was always related to their children, either their emotions at being separated from them or the guilt at being in the situation that they're in the impact that they know that's going to have on the children, or the sense of worthlessness that they feel as imprisoned mothers that makes them think their children would be better off without them. And we have to recognise and work with that risk, because when we have mothers in custody, whether we always believe it or not, whether it's always obvious to us or not, very often their primary focus remains their children. And so asking a mum who's just had a phone call from a 13-year-old child saying that they're being bullied at school and they're suicidal, asking that mum to then go into a sentence planning meeting, she's not going to be able to focus. She's not going to be able to engage. So we have to respond to this layer of motherhood in order to be able to do the best with our women in custody. And we have to prepare them for release, because my research shows women... One of my women is 46 years post-release and she still has symptoms of PTSD. She still experiences PTSD from the separation from her children. And women really struggle post-release to reintegrate into their family, to reintegrate into motherhood, to accept either the loss of the children or the temporary loss of the children or the dilution of the maternal role. It's an absolute minefield. And currently, it's not really addressed.
Sorry to interrupt, but not to mention the reunification and when the mother comes out, and the amount of stories I've heard of, you know, mothers who are obviously desperate to see their children who might be older now. And then, of course, and understandably, the children feel like they've been abandoned and left and maybe have serious anger towards their mother, and how difficult that process is too. And you sort of think, my God, this untold damage that we're heaping on people left, right and centre, it can be stopped and minimised. You know, we can't eradicate this stuff, of course. You know, we have to be realistic. But, you know, what I'm interested in, and what one small thing is interested in, is minimising this sort of colossal damage to just lesser amounts even. Even that would be better.
Yeah. I think you're right. And I think the impact, you know, the especially with teenagers, when, you know, when mums come back out, there are those challenges, and mum might have lost her disciplinary role because the teenagers might say, well, how can you tell me what to do? You've been to prison. And for other mums, they almost feel the need to serve a penance. So they might spoil their children, you know, and give them anything and be reluctant to discipline because they want to make it up to their children for where they've been. But it doesn't just stop at that layer as well. The amount of women have spoken to who, when they've been out a long, long time, and perhaps their daughters or sons have gone on to have their children, there's a whole nother layer of shame and blame that comes back out, because when the daughters particularly become mothers, they will then have another response of, how could you have done this? Now I'm a mother. How could you have done this to us? How could this have happened? And all of the shame and blame comes back, and the relationship between mothers and their adult children reverts back to how damaged it was when the mothers first came out. It's a real intergenerational impact. I've got some grandmothers who, their grandchildren don't know that they ever served a prison sentence. So one of my grandchild had asked her what she'd done for her 21st, and she said she felt the shame flooding back and the trauma of her prison sentence flooding back at her, because she knew she'd been locked up for her 21st, but her grandchildren don't know she'd ever been to prison. So she feels like she avoids deep conversations with her grandchildren in case these questions come up. So it's still her sentence from, you know, 30, 40 years ago is still affecting her relationship with her grandchildren. It's never ending. I mean, one of my mums, she called it a life sentence. She said, you know, prison for any mother is a life sentence. And the more and more women I see and speak to, the more I see that that is actually true. And, you know, we have to do more to mitigate the harms for women. And I think first and foremost, that would be sending far fewer women to prison, particularly for these short sentences that are unnecessary, but that still have a forever impact. Just however short they are, they have a forever impact. And I think that has to be the first thing. But we also have to be better at responding to women and responding to women who are mothers during the prison sentence, and importantly, supporting them post-release. And that can be just minor things. Like I use this example a lot, but a mum said to me, you know, she'd gone to prison and an officer had said to her, you know, there was a conversation about children, and the officer had said to her, "You've got four children." And in that one statement, she'd heard, you've got four children, you're a bad mother, you shouldn't be here. What a terrible mother to be here and have four children. When just by saying, "So you have four children, what are their names?" completely changes that interaction and takes away that shame and blame. And so some of the work I'm doing with Sodexo at the minute particularly is around staff training about working with mothers and, you know, kind of trying to encourage officers and enable officers to have the skills to engage with mothers differently and in a way that is positive rather than negative, because that makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. Are there any differences when it comes to women from different cultures and different backgrounds?
Definitely. I mean, Sophia Bunsey does some brilliant work with Muslim women in prison, for example. And, you know, the women in her project spoke about the additional layers of shame of culture of being a criminalised woman and how that then impacts on them as mothers particularly. And, you know, I've had experiences with women from different cultures where the mother-in-laws have taken a really significant lead with children while they've been in care. And because sometimes there's a power relationship and a power dynamic there that can be different, the children are then not returned because that mother's not deemed, you know, worthy enough to be a mother. And I've got one mum in my research who is a black mum. She'd gone to her probation officer and her probation officer had said to her, not only have you let yourself down, but you've let your race down. And she'd actually said this to her, "You've let your race down because as a black woman, you've conformed to a stereotype, you've fed into the stereotype." So this mother had that layer of shame as a woman, as a mother, and as a black woman. So I think intersectionality is really, really important, and we absolutely have to factor in race and culture, particularly in relation to women and motherhood. It's so important.
Yeah, I started off my sort of prison career in Nepal, and the first prison I ever went into was Central Jail in Kathmandu. And over there, for instance, you know, when a mother goes to prison, all her children go with her, because actually it's seen as such a terrible thing that the children are then cast out of the family as well. So they all go to prison at the same time. And so that was my sort of induction, if you like, into the world of children and prisoners, both male and female. So I've always been fascinated by the topic. But Lucy, thank you so much for all the work that you're doing on it. And I don't mean for that to sound condescending, which it often can, but you know, it's so brilliant that, you know, you're moving into the gaps and doing the research in the areas where there just simply hasn't been any research and there simply isn't any data. You know, it's 2021. How can this be that we are just now trying to get this stuff out and to get a spotlight on it?
It's such impactful work because small changes will make such a difference to how women and particularly mothers experience the criminal justice system. I always quote Rob Canton, who says we can't have effective criminal justice without having effective social justice. And I think that has to be the starting point. We have to address some of the inequalities that women and especially mothers face in the community in order to make good some of the damage and harm that occurs again in the criminal justice system. You know, there's a lot to do.
There's a lot to do, but I'm optimistic that in 10, 20 years' time, hopefully, we'll both still be alive and we'll actually see some change happening.
Definitely. I do see small changes all of the time. I am optimistic, but there's a lot more to do.
Great. Lucy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Edwina.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe Also, rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.